Tantor Audio presents A Sorceress of His Own by Diane Duval, narrated by Kirsten Potter. Author's note. Dear listener, one of the questions I am asked most often is what inspired my Immortal Guardian series, paranormal romance novels and novellas that feature dark and dangerous heroes, kick-ass heroines, action, passion, and romance. The easy answer is, this book, A Sorceress of His Own. There were, of course, other sources of inspiration, a documentary on the Water Bear, research into possible explanations for the emergence of vampire folklore, and a biography of King George, to name a few. But long before Sarah Bingham rescued Roland Warbrook with her trusty shovel in Darkness Dawns, I wrote A Sorceress of His Own, and The Gifted Ones were born. If you're unfamiliar with my Immortal Guardian series, both the vampires and immortals that people it are infected with a very rare symbiotic virus that conquers, then replaces the immune system, granting those it transforms dramatically enhanced senses, greater speed and strength, and incredible regenerative capabilities, along with an unfortunate photosensitivity and a need for blood. Vampires are humans who have been infected with the virus. Immortals are gifted ones, men and women born with advanced DNA that bestows upon them special gifts or abilities ordinary humans lack, who have been infected with it. Alyssa, the heroine of A Sorceress of His Own, was the first gifted one I created, and she, along with Seth and Marcus, both of whom are prominent figures in my Immortal Guardian series, fired my imagination and inspired many of the what-ifs that drove me to create my Immortal Guardians. I hope you will enjoy her story. Diane Duval. Prologue. England, 1191. "Where is Father?" Alyssa asked, unable to bear the leaden silence a moment longer. "Outside." Kneeling in the rushes that covered the earthen floor of the modest hut in which Alyssa had been raised, her mother completed one last stitch, then bit off the end of the dangling thread. Alyssa glanced through the window, but did not spy him. A brisk, cool breeze wafted in, accompanied by morning sunshine. Leaves, the color of a golden sunset, had just begun to fall in preparation for winter, and painted the forest around the isolated dwelling with bright color. "Is he angry?" she asked hesitantly. "He is worried," her mother corrected, "as we all are." Alyssa's second cousin, Megan, slumped in a chair by the hearth, brow furrowed, teeth nibbling her lower lip. The two were of a similar age and had been the best of friends in their youth until Meg's parents had been slain when Alyssa was 10. Megan had gone to live with her grandsire then, far enough away to limit the time the two could see each other. Rising, her mother crossed to the table in the corner and tucked her needle away. Matthew, Alyssa's father, may be blind, but he had lost none of his carpentry skills. He had lovingly created every table, chair, stool, and chest in their small home. Alyssa gave the folds of the long black robe she wore a little shake and checked the length. Perfect. Her grandmother was a couple of inches taller than Alyssa, so all of the robes had needed to be shortened. "Thank you." The fear and sadness that shadowed her mother's features when she returned tightened Alyssa's chest. "Please reconsider this, daughter." Swallowing hard, she shook her head. "This is what I want. I have made my decision." Male voices erupted outside, one soft and low, the other angry. Alyssa's brother, Jeffrey, yanked open the door and stomped inside. His lips tightened when they fell upon her, garbed in her grandmother's black robe. "I did not wish to believe Mother when I received her missive. What have you done?" Alyssa raised her chin. "What I have long wished to do. I have taken steps to replace Grandmother as Westcote's wise woman." He swore foully. "Jeffrey," her mother reprimanded. "Well, 'tis madness," he raged. Alyssa held on to her own temper, knowing his was fired by concern for her. "'Tis not madness. Grandmother grows weaker and more frail every year. She cannot continue to serve as Westcote's wise woman. Then Westcote can do without one. I see no reason why they should when, shielded by these robes, I can take her place with none being the wiser. They should, her brother hissed, because the path you have chosen will invariably lead to either heartbreak or death. Her mother's and Meg's expressions betrayed their agreement. I know not why it should, Alyssa countered. He took a step forward. Think you I know naught of your feelings for him, for the valiant Earl of Westcote, or the monstrous Earl of Westcote, if the rumors are true? She bristled. A victim of rumor yourself, you know people are always eager to believe the worst of others. The false rumors told of mother's supposed witchcraft nigh resulted in her death, yet you would place your faith in the lies told of Lord Dillon? Violence follows him wherever he goes. Can you deny that? You would condemn him for defending his king? Our king? He clamped his lips shut. Meg ventured to speak. Do you not fear him, Alyssa? The rest of England does.
With good reason, Geoffrey muttered.
Nay, I do not. You are all well aware the rumors hold no truth. I have seen with mine own eyes the kindness of which Lord Dillon is capable, and grandmother has said naught but good things of him.
Too many good things. She has filled your head with foolish fancy.
Geoffrey paced away a few steps. Alyssa caught her mother's eye. Know you where grandmother is? I think she is fetching her paints. I shall see why she tarries. Alyssa waited for her mother to leave, then turned to her brother. Ask me again why I do this.
Why must you do this?
He asked helplessly as he returned to her side. Because I am tired of hiding. He motioned to the midnight material that covered her.
This is not hiding.
Do not play the half-wit, she snapped. You— I love mother, she interrupted, keeping her voice low so it would not carry. But I do not want the life she has chosen. I do not wish to live in total isolation, in constant fear for my life. You know I have always wished to use my gifts the way they were meant to be used. I wish to help others, heal others, guide them whenever I can. And serving as Lord Dillon's wise woman will allow me to do that without risking my life. Her brother snorted.
You will risk your life the very night you begin to serve him. You intend to help Lord Dillon take Brimshire, do you not?
She nodded. Are you certain you can gain us entry?
Aye. Mother sent me there ere the siege began, saying only that I would be needed. They think me one of them.
She must have had a vision.
Aye. And had she seen the reason I would be needed, I would have refused.
Geoffrey, you will die in his service, Geoffrey predicted, his face full of torment.
Violence does follow him wherever he goes, and your love will drive you to heal every wound he incurs, fatal or nay.
He shook his head.
I do not wish to lose you, and again ask you to reconsider this.
She swallowed hard. I have made my decision. He stared at her a long moment, and 'tis yours to make. I shall await you outside. He left without another word. Alyssa looked to Meg. Ever her friend and supporter, Meg made no attempt to sway her from the path she had chosen. Alyssa's mother and grandmother entered. Her grandmother crossed to Alyssa and offered her a cloth bag.
The paints for your hands. Show me again you know how to use them.
Alyssa obediently took them and, seating herself at the table, applied them the way her grandmother had instructed. When she finished, her youthful hands bore the appearance of an old woman's, the skin appearing thin and spotted with age. Her grandmother nodded her approval. You taught me well, Alyssa said. Thank you, grandmother. Tucking the paints back in the bag, Alyssa rose. Her grandmother clasped her hands and stared at her a long moment.
I understand why you do this,
she said softly, and Alyssa could see in her world-weary eyes that she did. She understood all of the reasons that had driven Alyssa to take her place as Westcote's wise woman. Alyssa's mother took a step toward them.
Mother, do not—
Beatrice, her grandmother countered sharply. Her mother quieted.
Perhaps I did speak too fondly of Lord Dillon, her grandmother mused. Alyssa shook her head. You only spoke the truth. Sadness softened her grandmother's voice. He will never love you, Alyssa. She knew her grandmother did not say it to hurt her, but it did, nonetheless. I am well aware of that. He will think me the same aged wise woman who served his sire and his grandsire. He will think me you, and will continue to believe such as long as I wear these robes. Alarm lit her mother's face. You do not intend to remove them, do you? Nay, Alyssa assured her. Grandmother made me vow I would not, for my own safety. Her grandmother squeezed her hands.
You are so innocent, Alyssa. You know not what 'tis like to love one who cannot love you in return. What 'tis like to love one who will never be free to love you in return. The pain that accompanies the pleasure of being in his presence every day. You know not the misery that awaits you when you inevitably watch the one you covet turn to another.
I know it well, she insisted, and thought it worth the price she would pay. Her grandmother sighed.
Nay, you do not. But I fear you soon will.
She released Alyssa's hands and crossed to the hearth. Alyssa's mother stepped forward, tears glistening in her eyes.
We have sheltered you all your life from the hate directed at those who bear gifts such as ours. I fear we sheltered you so much that you do not understand the true danger you will face once you leave here.
How can I not understand it, knowing your past and grandmother's? Alyssa asked her. The hate and fear of aught different had nipped at her grandmother's heels all her life. The same hate had led a man of the cloth to set Alyssa's mother afire in an attempt to purify her of the devil's taint when her mother was but a girl. And a similar hate had driven men to hunt and slay Meg's parents, who had also been gifted ones.
But I will be safe at Westcote, Mother. No one will chance earning the fierce Earl of Westcote's wrath by attempting to burn his wise woman at the stake, or fear him too much.
When her grandmother returned, she bore several wineskins.
Are you certain you wish to begin your service to Lord Dillon with such a grand endeavor?
Aye. If I succeed in taking Brimshire for him, he will be too distracted to notice any peculiarities that will arise during my transition.
For the first time, her grandmother's lips twitched with a faint smile.
'Tis bold and clever. You shall serve Lord Dillon well.
Smiling with just a hint of nerves, Alyssa lifted her robe and secured the skins to her waist with a rope.
You must be diligent, Alyssa, her grandmother advised, and maintain your guise at all times. Never leave your chamber without the robes and cowl. Never allow anyone more than the briefest glimpse of your hands, and never slip and speak in your own voice.
Alyssa adopted the elderly rasp she had been practicing for months.
I shall be most diligent indeed, grandmother.
Meg's face lit with awe. She sounds just like you. Alyssa grinned. Her grandmother grimaced.
Surely I do not sound as old as that.
Of course not, Alyssa lied, returning to her own voice.
Her grandmother's wrinkled features reflected her disbelief as she helped Alyssa straighten her robe.
Should anyone at Westcote seek to harm you, all you need do is duck out of sight and doff these robes. None will know a young woman resides beneath them. When they find the robe, they will search for a doddering old woman, not one who blooms with youth.
Alyssa nodded. Her grandmother forced a smile and embraced Alyssa with frail arms.
'Tis time.
Thank you, grandmother, Alyssa whispered past the lump that rose in her throat.
Prove them wrong, her grandmother whispered. Do not let your love for Lord Dillon cost you your life.
When her grandmother stepped back, Meg rose and embraced Alyssa. Then Beatrice stepped forward and hugged her close.
Be safe, daughter.
Alyssa nodded, unable to speak, as tears burned the backs of her eyes and thickened her throat. As her mother, grandmother, and cousin watched, Alyssa straightened her shoulders and raised the black cowl that would conceal her features from that day forth. Alyssa shivered beneath her dark robe as she and Jeffrey stole through the Stygian forest. The light of a full moon dappled the foliage around them, enabling the two to negotiate the forest's maze without the benefit of a torch. Though brittle leaves carpeted the forest floor, a light rain had softened them, permitting silent footsteps that enabled the two to elude the army encamped outside Brimshire's walls. Jeffrey touched her arm, bringing her to a halt. Leaning down, he pointed and whispered in her ear, "The postern gate lies through there." "You are certain you can gain us entry?" she asked again. He nodded. "They think me one of them. And, should any seek to prevent our entry, I shall use my gifts to attain it. I must speak with Lord Dillon first." Jeffrey's hand tightened on her arm. "There is still time to change your mind, Alyssa. You do not have to do this." She patted his hand, then gently removed it. "I shall return anon." Leaving Jeffrey, she once more crept through the forest until she reached the main camp. Simple structures had been erected over the long months to protect the men from arrows, should any be let loose by the guards atop the castle walls. They also provided the men with shelter to stave off the illness that could be spawned by poor conditions arising from long sieges. The light of the fires grew brighter as she approached the break in the trees. Her heart began to pound when she located the Earl of Westcote. He sat before a fire with a number of his men. Armor encased his broad shoulders. A sword, nigh as long as Alyssa was tall, lay at the ready beside him. Flickering flames sent golden light dancing across his handsome features, providing a pleasing contrast to the dark stubble that coated his strong jaw and chin. The scowl that creased his brow and made others tremble sparked no fear in Alyssa. She was far too nervous and excited. Tonight, she would begin her service as Lord Dillon's wise woman. Frustration beat at Dillon. Months had passed, and the Lord of Brimshire seemed no closer to surrender than he had been when the siege began. "Do you think they are as well fortified with provisions as Lord Edward would have us believe?" Sir Simon asked. Several dead cows had been launched over the walls today. At first, Dillon and his men had feared they were diseased. 'Twas a common tactic in sieges. But the cows had instead been meant to convey a simple message. Those besieging the castle would starve long before the inhabitants of the keep would. They had food aplenty inside the stout walls. Dillon shook his head. "I know not, and have reached the end of my patience. Tomorrow we will begin constructing siege towers." He had hoped to take the castle, one King Richard had granted him when Dillon had saved his life, without violence, without death, without destroying walls and structures he would then have to rebuild once Brimshire became his. "Do you wish to send for the Trebuchet?" Ready to be done with it, Dillon nodded and started to speak. A twig snapped in the forest. Every man present leapt to his feet and drew his sword. A small black-robed figure stepped into the firelight, seeming to manifest directly from the darkness itself. Several knights hastened to cross themselves. Dillon motioned for all to stand down and waited for them to relax before the fire once more. Sheathing his own weapon, he crossed to the wise woman's side. "My lord," she greeted him in her raspy voice. Dillon guided her away from his men. "What do you here, wise one? 'Tis not safe." How had she traveled such a distance? He saw none of his men with her. Had she come alone? "My gifts told me you have need of my services," she whispered. He could remember a time in his youth when her voice had been stronger, but age had gradually weakened it, first cracking it, then reducing it to this faint relic of its former self. None knew the wise woman's true age. The more superstitious of his people, those who crossed themselves whenever she passed them, believed she possessed the powers of immortality and could claim centuries to her past. Others placed her age nigh that of the elders, who all swore she had served the Westcote lords for as long as the oldest among them had walked the earth. All Dillon knew with any certainty was that she had seen at least 20 years, for she had advised his father throughout Dillon's youth. He recalled his intense curiosity as a boy. She had stood straighter then, had seemed taller, almost grandiose to a precocious child who would not see his final height of a few inches above 6 feet for many years. A floor-length black robe with long sleeves that fell beneath her fingertips, and a cowl that shielded every feature and defied even the strongest gust of wind, had been and still was her constant companion. As Dillon understood it, none had ever looked upon her unmasked, not even his grandfather, beside whom the elders insisted she had first stood. Since acquiring the title, Dillon had had little chance to speak with this mysterious woman who had served his family for so many years. He had spent most of his time quashing a cousin's rebellion, then attempting to claim Brimshire. And, though he had known her peripherally all his life, he had not yet decided how he felt about her coming to him as his adviser. "All goes well here, Sia," he told her. 'Twas not a lie. There had been no losses on his side, no sickness. As far as sieges went, this had been an uneventful one. "Tomorrow we will begin constructing siege towers. Such will not be necessary." He stared at her, shocked that she had interrupted him. Everyone else feared him too much to risk the fury they all believed would erupt if they did so. "I know not—" "Rest easy, my lord," she whispered, interrupting him again. "Brimshire will be yours by sunrise." So saying, she backed away and let the forest swallow her. Nonplussed, Dillon heard no sound of movement, but knew, without grabbing a torch and thrusting it forward, that she was gone. He turned to face his men. Judging by their uneasy expressions, most had overheard. "What do you suppose she meant by that?" Simon asked. Dillon knew not, and, retaking his place before the fire, decided to forego sleep until she returned. Hours later, as the sun rose and painted the land around them with a rosy dawn, a loud clanking sound disrupted the silence. Dillon stood and faced the castle. The drawbridge began to lower. Waking his men with a single command, he mounted his destrier and drew his sword. Squires fetched mounts. Knights climbed into saddles and drew weapons that glimmered in the strengthening sunlight. The heavy outer portcullis slowly rose as Dillon and his men took up a position some distance from the end of the drawbridge. A charged silence followed. The inner portcullis rose. All waited in tense anticipation for men to pour forth with a battle cry. Minutes passed as bird songs serenaded them. Then a small black-robed figure emerged, face hidden by her cowl. Striding boldly across the drawbridge, she halted when she reached Dillon's side. "As I said, my lord, siege towers will not be necessary. Brimshire is yours." Dillon stared down at her in astonishment as his men all crossed themselves in a flurry of motion. She had accomplished in one night what a 6-month siege had not. Just how far did her gifts extend? Chapter 1. England, 1198. As still as though he were an extension of the ramparts themselves, Dillon stared out over the slumbering keep. The same fog that partially veiled it stroked his skin with ghostly fingers and lent an eerie echo to the sounds of the guards who walked the walls. She was there, behind him. He had not heard her approach, but he could feel her presence as surely as he could the damp, chilly breeze. "What brings you to these battlements on this dreary night, Sia?" he asked without turning around.
"Your troubled spirit called to me," she responded, her voice still but a whisper of its former self. "How may I serve you, my lord?"
He did not speak for many moments. His spirit was indeed troubled. He felt so very weary and old, as old as some believed the crone hidden in darkness behind him was.
"Our king has granted me another keep," he said finally. "A fitting reward for one of his most loyal subjects. Think you he has forgotten I fought in opposition to him at Le Mans? He would not hold that against you. You were defending your king. I believe he regrets now being a less than dutiful son to Henry."
"Spoken most diplomatically, wise one," he murmured, amused by her reference to Richard's hostile rebellions.
"And you have since proven your loyalty to King Richard many times over. You took an arrow for him at Acre. You helped put an end to Prince John's insurrection. 'Tis proper for him to offer his most fearsome knight a prize or two."
The laughter that rumbled forth from him carried a hint of the despair that had weighed him down of late.
"What amuses you, my lord?" she inquired.
He glanced at her over his shoulder. As usual, she stood in the shadows, her robe hiding what little may have been revealed by a rogue ray of moonlight.
"Take my hand, wise one," he commanded, extending it toward her, "and tell me what you see."
She reached out and clasped his hand with one of hers. For one brief instant, he caught a glimpse of age-spotted, yellow-tinged skin stretched across blue veins and slender fingers, before the sleeve of her robe glided forward to hide both their hands from his view. It was the most he had seen of her in the 7 years she had advised him. The warmth of that hand, so old and frail, surprised him, distracting him for a moment.
"Well," he prodded, "how fearsome is the man who stands before you? Look closely. What do you see?
What do I feel?" "A great lassitude, my lord."
"Aye."
"You are dissatisfied with your existence. You have grown weary of battle, of killing."
He looked down at the obscured inner bailey with a sigh. "Sometimes I wonder if I shall ever be able to erase the cursed stench of blood and death from my nostrils, the images of it from my memory." The wind picked up, swirling the night mist into mystical shapes and patterns from dreams.
"What else do you see?"
"You know I cannot read your thoughts, my lord."
"Nay, but emotions and desires are clear to you, seer. Interpret mine as you will."
"Very well."
Focusing intently on that which he wished her to see, he felt his hand heat where she touched it as she delved deeper with her peculiar gift.
"Your greatest wish is for peace."
"Aye."
"And?"
She seemed to stall, mayhap mistrusting the information her gift relayed.
"Continue."
"A wife, my lord."
He wondered at the surprise manifested in that statement. With her powers, she saw him more clearly than anyone he knew, even his younger brother Robert, with whom he shared almost all of his secrets, did not know him as this one did. Granted, on those rare instances when she touched him, 'twas usually with the intent to heal, but this desire for a wife had lingered in his heart and mind for some time now, growing stronger alongside his discontent. Surely his soothsayer had become aware of it ere now.
"You sound surprised."
'Tis true I did not know you wished to wed," she admitted slowly, "but that in itself does not surprise me. 'Tis your reasons for doing so."
He chuckled, a sound rife with self-mockery, and tightened his grip on her fingers.
"So tell me, seer, why the land's most formidable warrior, save our illustrious lion-hearted ruler, desires a bride."
Shielded by her dark robe, Alyssa hesitated, uncertain of his mood. She had never seen Dillon quite like this before.
"'Tis not for the customary reasons, my lord."
His large, rough, battle-scarred hand gripped hers with an almost desperate need for contact, or mayhap reassurance. One would think that, after 7 years of serving him, such a simple touch would no longer speed her pulse or make her breath catch.
Yet, as always, she had to struggle to keep her hand from trembling within his grasp, to restrict her voice to the steady whisper she had worked so hard to perfect. Dylan turned his face away from her, as if to hide his despondency from her view, though he must know she felt it as strongly as he did when they touched. High forehead, straight nose, despite the numerous battles he had fought, strong jaw now clenched in an effort to control his emotions. It was a handsome face, marred only by two small scars. One divided his left eyebrow, a second adorned the right side of his chin. He had acquired both before she had come into his service, just after Dylan had turned 63. She had let naught mar him since. Though still a young man, the hair at his temples was almost entirely silver. The rest of his thick locks were only sparsely peppered with gray. Those that teased his collar remained as dark a brown as the day he had come into this world, so dark they were nigh black. How often she had wished she could reach up and touch those locks, discover if they were as soft as they appeared.
"You do not seek a woman to bear you heirs or increase your lands and fortune, as most do," she said.
"Do I not?"
"Nay, my lord."
"What then?" Energy strummed through her as she sifted through his emotions. She had come to know him well over the years, better than most. Mayhap that explained why her gift always seemed to stretch a bit further with him, allowed her to see more.
"You seek a tender smile and a warm embrace, awaiting you on the steps of the dungeon each time you return from venturing forth on the king's business or on your own."
His eyes squinted slightly, deepening the faint lines the sun had placed at their corners. "What else?"
"You want a loving presence, to sit with you by the fire of an evening, to converse with you, teach you how to laugh again, to find joy in life, someone in whom you can confide."
She frowned.
"Someone who will be as gentle with you as you wish to be with her."
The hand in her grasp gradually relaxed, as though he were being lulled by her revelation of his deepest fantasy. Regret that she could not fulfill that fantasy left a bitter taste in her mouth. Alyssa's grandmother had warned her that she would one day come to loathe these robes and the silence they required. Her mother had, too. But she had been young when she had donned them and accepted the many responsibilities of Westcote's wise woman, a mere 10 and 6, and had not seen beyond the opportunity to be close to the compassionate, courageous, and, aye, comely, Lord Dylan.
"You wish your bride to come to you innocent," she forced herself to continue, "pure but without fear. You dream of spending many long nights making love with her."
Her face heated.
"And many more falling asleep with her cradling you close to her, chasing off the grisly nightmares that plague your sleep."
Silence engulfed them when she finished. He withdrew his hand, seeming almost reluctant to sever the contact. "I ask again," he said softly, his lips turning down at their corners.
"How fearsome is the warrior who stands before you?"
"No less fearsome than he was ere I saw him."
He shook his head.
"How they all would laugh if they knew the truth." "And what truth might that be, my lord?"
"That one of England's most ruthless killers, a man who inspires terror in all, leaves blood and destruction in his wake wherever he travels, and is rumored to devour small children for supper, desires only peace, and a wife who will be little more than a nursemaid to him."
"A nursemaid to your children, mayhap, a companion to you. There is no shame in loving, my lord."
He turned to her, his features alight with curiosity. "Know you of love, then?" "Aye, ever since she was a child and had witnessed, from a distance, his kindness toward her grandmother, his defense of her when others repudiated her.
I have not attained this age without knowing it, my lord."
"I confess I know not precisely what age you have attained, seer."
"You are not alone in your ignorance."
He grinned at her evasion, as she had known he would. "Fear not, I will not press you." "How very wise of you," she drawled, eliciting a sharp laugh. "Why should I," he continued in teasing tones, "when your age does not rouse nigh as much curiosity as your appearance?" "I have long considered curiosity a bothersome, unhealthy emotion, my lord."
"Then why do you take such pleasure in generating it amongst my people?" he countered.
She allowed her laughter to emerge as a raspy chuckle.
"Mayhap you are the true seer here, my lord, for you know me too well."
Dillon stared at her, wishing that were true. The top of her head barely came to his shoulder. 'Twould be so easy to reach out, drag back the cowl that covered it, and finally discover what he had spent far too much time pondering. But he would not do so. He would never violate her trust in such a way, not when she treated his own with such care.
"Why is it that you think you will never find the wife you long for?"
His stomach clenched.
"Because she does not exist." "You do not believe there is a woman in all of England capable of the tenderness and devotion you desire?"
"I believe there are many such women, but each and every one of them cringes at my approach. When I come to bed at night, I want a wife to tremble with passion, not fear."
"All women do not fear you," she stated plainly.
When he raised a brow, her cowl tilted to one side.
"Think you I do not know all that transpires in your domain?"
A warm flush crept up his neck when he realized she referred to the women who occasionally satisfied his needs.
"Do not think that because they sought me out and shared my bed, those women were not just as frightened as the others." "If they were frightened, they would not have approached you."
Frowning, he crossed his arms over his chest.
"You cannot have lived so many years and remained that naive."
When she remained damningly silent, his tone mellowed.
"Or have you?"
'Twas something he had never considered before, her innocence or lack thereof. As many years as she had lived, and as much of the world as she had seen, he had assumed that at some point, well, he had once even found himself wondering if she and his father had not been lovers for a time. "Very well," he said, when no rejoinder was forthcoming. "The women who have offered themselves to me did so because their fear excites them. They did not come to me for love-making. They came seeking domination."
"And who better to dominate than one with your reputation?"
she finished for him.
"I."
Dillon tamped down the anger and embarrassment that threatened. He had never divulged that particular secret before. Not even to Robert, who often bedeviled him about his long, self-imposed bouts of celibacy. A woman had not sought Dillon out with affection since he had left on his first campaign. Even women who desired the power and wealth Dillon possessed kept their distance, dissuaded by the rumors of violence that cloaked him. The wise woman stepped up beside him, close but not touching. He did not look at her. He could not.
"'Tis true I know little of such things," she murmured,
and he knew how much that admission cost her. In their years of dealing with each other, she had revealed very little of herself to him, yet did so now as an act of contrition for pushing him to discuss what he obviously did not wish to.
"In this instance, I fear we share the same complaint, my lord," she added sadly.
"What complaint is that?" Dillon found himself holding his breath, unsure how to proceed, since she had never before offered up such personal information to him.
"Very few bother to look beyond our reputations to the individuals they conceal. If you recall, I inspire as much, if not more, fear in those who encounter me."
He realized the truth of her words as soon as she spoke them.
"I see the people cross themselves whenever I walk past, see mothers tug their children closer to them for protection, hear men hurl accusations of witchcraft and link my name with Lucifer's.
I have even had a stone or two thrown my way."
His head snapped around in furious disbelief. "Who dared to—"
"Do not exert yourself on my behalf. 'Twas long ago, and the culprits have since been repaid for their actions tenfold."
He found his anger slow to ebb. "Did you—" She sighed.
"Alas, nay, though the blame was placed with me."
"There have been other crimes perpetrated against you, have there not? Crimes you never mentioned to me?"
Her hood swung from side to side. "Only declarations of intent, my lord. The very reputation you despise has been my staunch defender these last 7 years. Knowing the trust you place in me, none would dare incur your wrath by following through on their threats."
At least it had done someone some good, he thought morosely, wondering at the same time if he should not call his people together and make his displeasure known over their harsh treatment of the woman at his side. The same woman who had healed many of them with her hands, sometimes bringing them or their children back from the brink of death.
"Why does King Richard's gift not please you?" she asked, guiding the subject back to their conversation's origins.
"Because I must lay siege to the keep in order to claim it. 'Twould seem its previous owner is not ready to relinquish his hold on it."
"Yet another battle for you to fight."
"Aye."
"There is more."
He could hide naught from her. "'Tis Pinehurst I've been given."
"Lord Camden's holding?"
Camden was son to Dillon's nearest neighbor, Lord Everard, Earl of Westmoreland, whom Dillon had admired and respected ever since he was in swaddling clothes.
"He has finally done it, then."
"What?"
"Beggared his estate through his own greed. His father worried that he would do as much, and should not be surprised by this turn of events."
"I suppose not."
"No doubt Camden compounded the problem by insulting the king. He has always acted rashly and with little thought."
"'Tis the way of it. His support of John during Richard's imprisonment was only the beginning, 'twould seem."
"When do you depart?"
"On the morrow."
"Perchance you could employ the same tactics you used to take Brimshire, thus eliminating the necessity of fighting."
He smiled. "Plan to steal in and lace their food and drink with another of your tasty sleeping potions, do you?" he asked, delighted by her inference that it had been his plan all along. In truth, he had not learned until the keep had fallen how exactly she had aided him that night.
"You need only ask, and I shall do as you command."
He shook his head. "I dislike your taking such risks. Were anyone to discover you—"
"They expect treachery to come in the form of brawny soldiers, not—"
and he could actually hear her smile—
"from a frail old woman."
Dillon paced away from her. It had worked well the last time. She had succeeded in drugging nigh every soldier within the gates. Those who had retained their faculties had surrendered as soon as they had seen him riding inside, his men directly behind him. No violence, no destruction, no unnecessary deaths. Yet unease trickled down his spine.
"Nay."
He returned to her side. "I like it not. Mix your potion, if you will, wise one, but I shall find another to smuggle it inside." She straightened.
"A premonition, my lord?"
"You know I do not share your gifts." He dragged an impatient hand through his hair. "I merely sense danger."
"To me, or to yourself?"
"Not so clear as that." He shook his head. "We both know what a knave Camden is. He will not fight honorably. I ask that you remain here, where I may be assured of your safety."
"And what assurances will I have of your safety, my lord? I should be by your side, should you have need of my services."
He could not help but be pleased by her concern. Whilst others thought him invincible, she worried over his safety as his mother might have had she lived. "I shall send for you, Hela, should I need you." She nodded with notable reluctance.
"And I shall fly to you on the wings of your swiftest stallion, my lord, the moment your messenger arrives."
His lips stretched in a grin others scarcely saw.
so long as you do not truly give the steed wings, or my men may flee. She responded with another raspy chuckle. Dylan pondered their conversation later as he lay sleepless in his bed. It might very well have been the most personal they had shared. It had certainly been the most revealing. She had always been a solitary figure, the wise woman, rarely speaking to anyone other than himself unless she was healing a wound. For some reason, he had assumed she wanted it thus, that her powers set her apart, that she preferred her own company to that of others, particularly since others were less than kind to her and seldom thanked her for her efforts when she helped them. But now, what a lonely existence she had led, year after year of enforced solitude, surrounded by people who feared and mistrusted her because of the gifts bestowed upon her at birth, gifts that were a blessing, but more often were viewed as a curse, gifts that should have exalted her, but instead had transformed her into a mere vessel to be used by his grandfather, then his father, and now Dylan. How had they rewarded her? What had they done to make her life easier, to ease her burden when she had eased theirs in so many ways? The thought unsettled him. His wise woman had been sorely misused, yet had never in her years of service uttered a single complaint. Even tonight, when she had spoken of those who had thrown stones at her, she had done so matter-of-factly, as if she had never considered that he might be willing to seek justice on her behalf. It pained him to know she thought as much, that she believed he did not value her more, considering the many days and nights she had staved off the worst of his loneliness. For, when she was not healing an illness, rendering aid to any who incurred an injury, or ensuring that his steward kept his castle running smoothly, the wise woman frequently remained at his side. The women he had met at court could barely manage to stutter a greeting when he joined them. The same held true for the men. Rumors of Dylan's supposed cruelty preceded him into every room, stilling a majority of the tongues present, and widening all eyes before he entered. 'Twas why he never stayed any longer than he had to, and left feeling like a fire-breathing dragon the villagers prayed would not demand a sacrifice. His companions, his knights, even his brother all knew how to praise and flatter and turn a pretty head. Dylan had no inkling where to begin. His resulting reticence and unsmiling countenance, coupled with the ruthless reputation he had earned on the battlefield, had therefore proven far too intimidating for the noble women he had met, inspiring the fear he had eventually, resignedly, come to expect. But such was not the case with the wise woman. She alone seemed invariably at ease in his presence. He felt no need to mince words with her, no need to examine every thought before he spoke it for fear of frightening or offending, no need to modulate his tone when vexed, nor monitor his bark when angered. Mayhap 'twas her age and her own power that made her such a comfortable companion for him, a kindred spirit, as she had implied on the battlements, garnering the same fear in others, unable to function normally in society because of it. Or mayhap 'twas because she alone was comfortable enough around him to always speak her mind. He knew only that he could relax with her, be more himself, though he always maintained a respectful distance. A scarcely audible scraping sound met his ears, disrupting his musings. Bolting upright, Dylan grabbed the sword he always kept within reach and prepared to defend himself. He listened, motionless, unable to locate the intruder in the dim light of the dying fire.
"Rest easy, my lord."
"Wise one." His muscles relaxing, he returned his sword to its resting place. "Did my troubled spirit call you to me again?" he queried, wondering what had drawn her to his chamber. Had she known he was thinking of her?
"Nay."
She drew closer, a small silhouette separating itself from a host of others.
"This time 'twas my own troubled spirit."
Remembering his desire to repay the debt his family owed her, he waited until she reached his bedside, then asked, deferentially,
"How may I serve you, wise one?"
The question seemed to take her aback.
"'Tis I who serve you, my lord,"
she responded with some confusion. "'You said your spirit is troubled. Is there naught I can do to aid you?" She shifted.
"'You misunderstand.
Then please explain."
"'I was pondering the words we shared earlier,"
she began haltingly, and he felt his bothersome, unhealthy curiosity mount.
"'Though I cannot locate your bride for you, my lord, I can ward off your nightmares, if only for one night.'
Her midnight robe wavered and shimmered as she thrust a mug of rather vile-smelling liquid toward him.
"'You would drug me?'
he demanded, shocked.
"'Twill not harm you.'
He eyed the mug dubiously. "'Tis not the same potion you plied the men of Brimshire with, is it?' It had taken some of the men 2 or 3 days to regain consciousness after consuming it.
"'Of course not,'
she retorted, her voice almost, but not quite, rising above a whisper for the first time in years.
"'Tis very mild. You will merely rest a little deeper, free of the threat of nightmares, and awaken refreshed on the morrow.'
He looked from the mug to her hooded figure. 'Twas tempting.' He could not remember the last time he had slept the whole night through without waking at least once to the sound of screams reverberating through his head. Unfortunately, I cannot leave myself so vulnerable, Hela. Every good soldier knew that sleeping too soundly could endanger a man's life.
No harm shall come to you whilst you sleep.
But
I will not allow it, my lord.
She added with a conviction that made him wonder once more at the true extent of her gifts. "'What of your troubled spirit?'
"'Your sleep will ease it.'
Once again he wished he could espy her features. "'Very well, wise woman.' He took the mug from her and, trusting her implicitly, drained its contents with a shudder and a grimace ere he handed it back to her. "'I thank you.'
"'Lie back and close your eyes,'
she instructed in a gentle voice.
"'Twill soon take effect.'
He did so, willing his mind to stop racing, silencing the questions that wanted to tumble from his lips. Her potion came swiftly to his aid. In only minutes he could feel himself tumbling off the precipice of consciousness. She was wrong, though. He did dream. Just once. He dreamed that, as he succumbed to sleep, his bride's fingers tunneled tenderly through his hair, smoothing it back from his forehead before gentle lips pressed a kiss there. "'Rest well, Dylan,' she said, in a lilting, melodious voice, as delicate fingertips trailed down his temple, past his ear, and followed the line of his jaw to the scar on his chin. "'I shall not leave your side.' Then, drawing the blankets up over his broad chest, she lay down atop them and lovingly cradled him against her when he turned into her reverent embrace. So soft, so soothing, so full of long-awaited love for him. Chapter 2 He had never slept so well. 'Twas the first thought that struck Dylan when his eyelids fluttered open as dawn broke, nor had he ever dreamed such sweet, tranquil dreams.
"'No nightmares beleaguered you, my lord?'
Startled, he looked toward the speaker and found the healer sitting beside his bed. Had she been there all night, watching over him to keep him from harm as she had promised?
"'None.' He answered, his voice still rough from sleep. I have never felt so rested.
I hoped 'twould be so. She sounded pleased. She must be exhausted. Yet another debt he owed her.
I did dream, though,
he murmured, a face drifting through his memory, her hood tilted slightly.
I thought no nightmares visited you.
'Twas no nightmare who held me close within her warm embrace, but one who must surely be the fairest maid in all the land.
Who?
My bride, seer. A languorous smile stretched his lips as he rose onto his elbows. You were right. She does exist, and she is more beauteous than any woman I have ever beheld, with skin as pale as snow and hair the color of midnight. But "'tis not possible,' she stuttered. Dylan frowned. Did she think him unworthy of such a maid? Had his disclosures the previous night made her think less of him, or convinced her that he was right, that he would never find a woman like the one in his dream, who could love him and would be willing to wed him? Ere he could press her for an explanation, pounding erupted on the door. "Enter," he called irritably. Sir Simon, his second in command, threw open the door and strode into the solar with a grin. His gaze flitted from Dylan to the wise woman. Stopping short, the big man sketched her a clumsy bow.
"Good morrow to you, wise one."
"Good morrow, Sir Simon."
He turned back to Dylan and smiled again.
"The cub approaches the gate."
Thrilled by his unexpected visitor, Dylan eagerly abandoned his concerns and turned bright eyes on the seer.
"Robert!"
Completely forgetting the revelation of her innocence the previous night, he threw back the covers, leapt naked from the bed, and hurriedly began to dress. Lingering in an umbral corner nigh the entrance of the great hall, Alyssa watched their reunion. A vigorous embrace, accompanied by the pounding of backs and hearty kisses on stubbled cheeks. At 25, Robert was an inch or so shorter than Dylan, with shoulders equally broad and hair as black as a raven's wing. Both men were incredibly handsome, their blue eyes sparkling with pleasure. But only Dylan made her breath catch and her heart pound within her breast. Memories surfaced of the way he had turned to her in his sleep last night and wrapped his arms around her, his large, muscled thigh slipping between hers, his lips resting upon the sensitive skin at the base of her neck. She had remained awake through the dawn, savoring his nearness, the way his arms would tighten every once in a while, and he would unconsciously urge her closer. Never had she felt more alive. Even now her body tingled in new ways and places, a condition that was not helped by visions of him leaping naked from the bed earlier. She had seen parts of him unclothed many times over the years, an arm, a leg, his chest. Never had she seen everything. Shaking her head, she forced her attention back to the present. All that remained of their family, the two Westcott warriors remained as close as siblings could be. Their sister had died in childbirth. One of their elder brothers had met a violent end in the Holy Land. The other had perished whilst defending his king during the revolt of 1174. Their mother had died birthing Robert, almost taking Alyssa's grandmother with her, as she had fought for the lives of mother and babe. And their father, the last Earl of Westcott, had breathed his last breath without warning one afternoon when his heart had failed him. So Dylan tended to be very protective of Robert.
"Where are your men?"
Dylan guided his younger brother into the great hall with an affectionate arm across his shoulders.
"Have they not accompanied you here to eat their way through my stores? I have never seen such appetites as theirs."
"I rode ahead. They shall be here shortly."
"You are limping."
"Faugh!" Robert blustered. "I am stiff from too damned many hours in the saddle."
Dylan called for ale as he and Robert sank into two chairs positioned before the largest of the four hearths the great hall boasted.
"You were the one who chose to leave and seek adventure. I have told you often that you are more than welcome to live out your days here with me."
"Aye, and your constant coddling would transform me into a maiden in no time."
Alyssa stifled a laugh. Dylan grimaced.
"Nevertheless, you need not hire out your sword. You take too many risks."
His brother gave a negligent shrug. "At least I am never bored." Silently, Alyssa moved closer, skirting the hall until she stood in a darkened corner, facing the younger man's back. Robert's unexpected visit pleased her. If anyone could supply a welcome distraction and lift Dylan's spirits, 'twas he. That limp of his concerned her, though. Robert had ever expressed uneasiness in her presence, and would rather have a barber pull a tooth than admit he required her healing skills. Did he not seek her out before nightfall, she would have to find some way to corner him.
"If boredom is your complaint," Dillon broached, "why do you not help me take Pinehurst?
Acquired another one, have you?"
"Aye, and Camden's at that. The damned tenants will not open the gates to me unless ordered to do so by their former master.
Not willing to give it up yet?"
"Camden will never surrender it willingly."
"Sounds like 'twill be a fight."
"Aye, I will join you."
"You do not sound overly enthusiastic."
Nay, he did not, and she assumed it the result of whatever injury had befallen him. Robert rubbed his eyes.
"I am but weary."
"Then remain here at Westcote where you belong. Forgo the tournament circuit and fighting other men's wars."
The younger man stubbornly shook his head. "I need land of my own, brother, and people of my own who will offer me the same loyalty and respect yours do you. As my heir, all you see around you will one day be yours. I am only your heir until you wed and your wife bears you a son."
Dillon shrugged, his strong features taking on a somewhat bleak cast. "Since I shall likely never wed, you shall remain my heir."
Alyssa bit her lip, regretting her earlier reaction to his dream, or rather to what he thankfully believed had been a dream. She had been so sure he had fallen asleep. The potion must not have been strong enough. He should not have been conscious, should not have remembered. It had seemed as though hours had passed ere she had finally given in to temptation, doffed her robe and, heart slamming against her ribs, lain down beside him. After 7 years of loving him, longing for him, she had craved his touch like a man in the desert craved water, and had thought him unaware, had thought herself safe from discovery, had thought it harmless to steal a moment with him, undisguised. She closed her eyes for a moment, remembering again how wondrous it had felt when he had drawn her into his warm embrace. She had been so surprised. Her heart had pounded so loudly she had feared he might hear it, and such scandalous desire had claimed her. Returning her attention to the brothers, she feared her distress this morning at discovering Dillon had not succumbed to the herbs, at least not completely, might have sounded more to his ears like mockery. Robert frowned.
"Never wed? What nonsense has the sorceress been filling your ears with now?"
He winced and shifted, seeking a more comfortable position. Watching from the darkness of her hood, Alyssa saw a scowl flit across Dillon's features. He made a slight motion with his hand, one that would go unnoticed by all save herself. Nodding, she soundlessly moved forward until she stood behind Robert's chair.
"You have not said what brings you to Westcote," Dillon said, changing the subject.
"Can a man not visit his family when the mood strikes him?" Robert griped. At Dillon's silent instruction, Alyssa rested her fingertips on Robert's shoulder.
"He is injured, my lord."
Robert lurched clumsily to his feet and spun around, a slew of epithets spewing from his lips.
"Unhand me, witch!" he shouted at last, and shoved her arm away. At least, that is all he had intended to do.
Alyssa saw the spark of fever and flash of pain that lit his eyes as his leg buckled and he lost his balance. He swiftly righted himself. But that shove had been forceful enough to send her crashing to the floor, where she landed so hard on her side that it knocked the breath from her. Fear lanced through her until she realized her cowl had not fallen away from her face to reveal her youth. The relief that followed was so great it almost dulled the throbbing that began just above her temple where her head had struck the floor. For a moment, all was still, as every occupant of the hall stared wide-eyed at her crumpled form lying amidst the rushes, then regarded the Earl with fascinated alarm, awaiting his response. Fury swept across Dillon's features.
"You will treat her with respect!" he bellowed at Robert, his face mottling, the veins in his neck standing out, ere he faced the knights, men-at-arms, and servants who gaped at them. "Every one of you will treat her with respect!"
"My lord, please," Alyssa objected, not wanting him to say or do aught that might foster greater feelings of resentment amongst his people.
Shoving his brother aside, Dillon closed the distance between them, grasped her elbow in one strong hand, and carefully helped her to her feet.
"'He did not do it a purpose,' she insisted, stepping away from him and breaking contact as she shook out her robes. "'Tis not necessary.'
Speechless, Robert stared at them both with dazed eyes filled with remorse. Alyssa had never seen Dylan strike his brother in anger, but feared for a moment he might do so now, so furious did he appear. She jumped when Dylan instead rested a hand upon her shoulder. He so rarely touched her. More of his people, upon hearing the commotion, crowded inside, generating a substantial gathering as he commanded their attention.
"This woman," he said,
his voice ringing clearly enough to reach every ear,
"is responsible for much of our good health and continued prosperity. Yet you all fear her and treat her with contempt."
Alyssa tried to ease back into the shadows, uncomfortable with the attention he drew to her. Dylan would have none of it and tightened his grip, keeping her at his side.
"Know you now that any offense made against her is an offense made against me and will be duly punished. Any kindness she bestows upon you will be repaid with one of your own. The wise woman has been blessed with gifts we have too often taken for granted. We will do so no longer."
Alyssa stared at him from beneath her cowl as onlookers glanced at one another uneasily. When it became apparent that he intended to say no more, all quietly dispersed. Dylan sighed and withdrew his touch, allowing her freedom. Her thoughts churned as she watched him wrap a supportive arm around his brother's waist. Docile now, Robert looped an arm around Dylan's shoulders and limped along at his side. Alyssa followed, keeping pace as they made their cautious way to the stairs, climbed them slowly, and headed into the chamber Robert called his own.
"I would you had not done that, my lord," she put forth.
"Why?"
Dylan grunted, practically carrying Robert the last few steps to his bed.
"Those who are unwilling to treat me kindly will no longer seek my aid."
Now that the first shock had worn off, she found his defense of her touching, gallant, his desire to see her treated with respect, heartwarming. But she could not perform her duties if the people of Westcote had even greater reason to avoid her. He snorted as he settled his brother none too gently against the pillows.
"If they cannot treat you kindly, then they deserve not your help. Where is he wounded?"
"I am fine," Robert grumbled, "his left leg just above the knee."
Dylan peeled off his brother's shoes and let them fall to the floor. Retrieving the dagger from his belt, he began to cut away the hose beneath that covered the area she had indicated.
"A gift withheld is no gift at all,"
Alyssa murmured as she leaned forward to get a closer look at the ugly gash he exposed.
"It has begun to fester. 'Tis why he is feverish. Had he waited much longer, he would have had inevitably lost either his life or his leg."
Robert paled, hearing that. Dylan, on the other hand, merely looked more furious.
"It must be cleansed first," she announced, and straightened.
Dylan stared at her over Robert's inert body, his brow furrowed.
"After his actions below, I should not ask this of you."
"You have not,"
she pointed out, then departed without another word to fetch her herbs and fresh water. Dylan watched the wise woman leave.
"I am sorry," Robert said, breaking the quiet that fell in her absence. "I am not the one you have abused."
"I know. I shall make amends."
"See that you do,"
Dylan ordered, disappointed in him.
"What made you behave so shamefully? She has come to your aid a number of times in the past, healing your injuries, banishing your ailments, lending you her strength during those early months after father died, whilst I quashed rebellions and settled things at Brimshire. She did not deserve that."
Robert grimaced. "Her presence and her powers have always made me uneasy. I fear my fever made me overreact."
"Do not call her witch again."
"What?"
"You heard me. Now, tell me how this came about."
It seemed to take Robert a moment to follow the change in subject. Another product of the fever, Dylan assumed.
"Thieves. Nigh Westcote?"
"Several days' march to the south."
He shook his dark, tousled head. "I have never seen such a large band.
but we managed to cut them all down. Dylan motioned to the swollen, pus-filled wound. Not quickly enough, apparently. A lucky thrust, the bastard. Though they dressed as beggars, I would swear they had been formally trained. The wise woman returned, carrying herbs, bandages, a basin filled with water, and a clean coif. She set the basin down on the table beside the bed, dipped the coif in the water, and squeezed the excess liquid from it. Dylan glared at his brother pointedly. Robert turned to the healer.
"Forgive me, wise one. I meant you no harm."
Dylan felt her gaze as she bent over the inflamed injury and began to clean it, miraculously managing to do so without exposing her hands. The glimpse he had caught of them last night had been a rarity.
"Mayhap a bit of sorcery courses through your blood, my lord," she murmured.
He smiled at her teasing response to Robert's about-face. When the man in question flinched at her ministrations, Dylan laid a comforting hand on his shoulder.
"I made things worse, did I not?" he asked after a while.
"How so, my lord?"
"Below, with the people."
Her shoulders lifted in a slight shrug.
"If you did, I shall hardly notice a difference."
He nodded, consumed with regret. "I only wished to make things easier for you."
"I know."
She examined the wound one last time to make certain 'twas clean.
"And I appreciate your efforts. But you cannot erase generations of superstition with a few sternly spoken commands, my lord."
Dylan wanted to say more, but was painfully aware of his brother's curious gaze sweeping back and forth between them. Straightening, the wise woman set the bowl aside, then placed her hands on the wound. Black material slithered forward to conceal the wonder she performed. It did not take long, no more than a minute. When she withdrew her hands, her sleeves trailing after her, the wound had closed. Though not completely healed, the angry red of its jagged edges had drawn together in a smooth pink line that posed no danger. Minor injuries, Dylan had noted, she healed entirely, leaving behind no trace of their existence. Deeper wounds, however, or those that had festered too long before being brought to her attention, she treated as she had Robert's, first cleaning them, then healing them to the point that they no longer posed a threat or generated too much discomfort. What remained, she treated with herbs and poultices. Mayhap healing the more serious injuries simply took more energy than her fragile form possessed. He frowned, although, regardless of their severity, she had always healed his wounds entirely.
"Are you unwell, Hela?"
His brother's tentative query made Dylan realize he had been staring fixedly at the pristine white bandage she had wrapped around Robert's thigh after sprinkling it with herbs. His eyes swerved to the wise woman, who swayed slightly. The long, sleepless night had taken its toll. As stubborn as she was wise, she shook her head in denial and moved toward the open door, a slight hitch in her step. Concerned, Dylan started toward her.
"Your brother needs you, my lord," she said without looking at him. "See that he remains abed and does not reopen his wound."
Realizing she did not welcome his assistance, he nodded.
"Thank you, wise one. I shall repay this debt."
"Any debt owed is mine, my lord."
With those words, she left.
"What do you suppose she meant by that?"
Robert asked, puzzled. Dylan stared at the empty doorway. "I know not." The next morning, Dylan stepped out into the inner bailey and nodded to Sir Simon. 3 years his junior, Simon had joined Dylan's service just before the siege of Brimshire had begun. Dylan knew not whence he had come or whose command he had left, but Simon had proven to be one of the strongest warriors with whom Dylan had ever sparred.
"How is the cub doing?" Simon asked.
In his early days at Westcote, Simon had remarked upon how fiercely Robert defended his older brother whenever rumors of his supposed cruelty arose. Simon had likened him to a wolf cub, and, much to Robert's chagrin, the dubious title had stuck. Dylan grunted, whining to be let out.
I do not whine, Robert snapped, limping slightly as he joined them. Nor have I ever. And, considering the number of enemies I have slain, and the fact that my ruthless reputation nigh rivals my brother's, do you not think it time you cease calling me cub?
Simon nodded solemnly, sunlight glinting off of his dark blonde hair.
Mayhap 'tis time I call you Pop instead.
Robert swore and cuffed Simon on the side of his head. Laughing, Simon shoved him back. The next thing Dylan knew, the two were down in the dirt, wrestling. Sighing, he bent down, grasped the backs of their tunics, and yanked them up and apart.
Children, please.
He gave Robert a little push toward the dungeon.
Go seek yourself a place by the fire. Should you reopen your wound, you will answer to the wise woman.
Muttering beneath his breath, Robert left. Simon grinned and shook his head.
What news of Camden?
'Tis as we expected. The Weasley bastard. He knows he cannot hold out against your forces. From all we have heard, his stores are already so depleted, any siege would be over in little more than a fortnight.
Yet a siege 'twill be. Camden still being a pain in the arse,
a gravelly voice interjected. His odor preceding him, the burly Gavin joined them. Tall and dark, he was a spirited fighter with a jovial disposition, but possessed such a strong aversion to baths that Dylan always attempted to remain upwind of him. Simon sighed.
Aye, asking for a siege he is. When do we depart?
Dylan considered Simon. You and I are of a size, would you not say? Simon looked at Dylan, then down at himself.
Aye, close enough.
Dylan glanced at Gavin. Think you he could pass for me, did he don my armor? Gavin rubbed the black stubble on his chin, tilting his head first one way, then the other.
As long as he kept the helm on to hide that golden boy hair of his, methinks 'twould work. Why, not willing to leave the cob?
Nay, not yet. Dylan looked at Simon and raised his eyebrows. What say you, Simon? Would you be willing to emulate me for the sake of our cub?
Though your armor will no doubt drag me down with its weight and chafe me endlessly, I would,
he quipped with a smile. Excellent. Gideon will bring you my armor, whilst you and the men make ready to leave. Gavin, you may wait and accompany me and a handful of others by week's end. With any luck, we will join them ere they reach Pinehurst. Simon nodded.
No doubt you will. Without the supply wagons to slow you down, you will travel much more swiftly.
Gavin grunted his agreement.
Do not engage Camden in battle if you reach Pinehurst first,
Dylan cautioned. Merely show yourselves and begin assembling the trebuchets. He had no reason to believe Camden would surrender Pinehurst until violence and force drove him to do it.
We will begin work as soon as we make camp.
Gavin chuckled as Simon walked away.
What? Just thinking of that fool Camden. No doubt he will stand atop the walls, cackling and casting insults down upon poor Simon's head, never guessing that he is not you.
Dylan smiled.
Aye, the jest will be on him, will it not?
Dylan did not take his leave for 3 more days, during which he drove Robert mad with mothering. At least, he mothered him when no others save Alyssa were present. The rest of the time, he gruffly complained about the inconvenience of having to postpone his departure. Alyssa found both brothers' behavior amusing and envied them the bond they shared. Because she disliked straying too far from Dylan's side or shirking her many duties at Westcote, she rarely had the opportunity to visit her own family. She could not safely send them missives, for they wished none to know where they resided, nor would she ask them to seek her here. Westcote and its people had caused both her mother and grandmother great grief over the years. She would not compel them to return. She could not see Meg, simply because 'twas not safe for Meg to travel alone, and her brother Geoffrey was busy attempting to discover his place in this world.
He treats me like a child, Robert muttered as he watched Dylan and his men canter across the drawbridge.
"You are all he has," she whispered, walking up behind him. Jumping, he spun around and squinted against the sunlight as she drew nigh. Unlike Dylan, who always seemed to sense her approach, Robert rarely seemed to be aware of Alyssa's presence until she spoke. Another reason, she supposed, for his uneasiness around her. "After all of the losses the two of you have suffered," she continued, "is it not natural that he might wish to protect you?"
"I suppose," he conceded, "but that does not make his insistence that I remain at Westcote easier to bear. My leg no longer pains me."
"Rarely pains me," he corrected, no doubt fearing she would see the truth.
"I have proven my skill in battle many times over. There is no reason I should not accompany him beyond his own stubbornness."
Alyssa studied him a moment.
"Is it merely boredom that agitates you?"
He paced away, then back. If she were to doff her cowl, she knew he would avoid her gaze. Such was how troubled he appeared.
I am sure 'tis all."
She did not speak again for several minutes. She had always felt turmoil in Robert when she had touched him. He had housed it since the first time she had healed him after coming into Dylan's service. Alyssa had assumed, in the beginning, that it resulted from his unease around her, but had gradually come to discern that it stemmed from something else. She knew not the cause, nor how deep it went. Unless his guard was lowered, as it had been when she had healed his latest wound, he sought to hide it from her. Yet Alyssa was a keen observer of those around her. Being shunned and having little opportunity to converse with others tended to leave one plenty of time in which to study them, and she had noticed that Robert's turmoil always increased during moments of inactivity, as if inactivity left him too much time to think or remember. But remember what? Whilst Robert continued to pace, limping a bit, Alyssa wondered if his desire to accompany Dylan stemmed from his need to stay busy, or if he worried that Camden might harm Dylan through treachery.
"Ere your arrival," she ventured at last, "your brother expressed an uneasiness about besieging Pinehurst."
Halting, Robert frowned.
"Did he?"
"Aye. 'Twas why he would not hear of my accompanying him, though I have done so often in the past. I begin to wonder if that is not the true reason you have been left behind as well."
"Camden can be a crafty little bastard when he is sober," Robert muttered, and returned to tower over her. "Have you seen the future, wise one? Know you the outcome of this campaign?"
"That is beyond my capabilities," she replied,
conveying apology with her aged whisper.
"My knowledge of future events is limited to occasional premonitory dreams, which I am afraid my sleep of late has lacked."
Nay, her most recent dreams had been consumed with wicked images of Dylan taking her in his arms and tumbling her to his bed, of him lowering his lips to hers, his hands caressing her. Robert raked his fingers through his hair, a gesture of frustration he had acquired from his brother.
"I will not let Dylan's misguided attempts to protect me keep me from guarding his back as he approaches Pinehurst."
He turned sharp eyes on her, as if daring her to disagree with him.
"I shall follow him and stay to the trees."
Alyssa nodded, relieved.
"I pray such precaution will prove unnecessary."
He seemed surprised.
"You will not prevent me from leaving?"
Her eyebrows flew up.
"I possess neither the power nor the authority to do so," he grunted.
"My brother places such faith in your counsel that I sometimes forget—"
That she was a servant? A peasant? Would that Alyssa could forget as well.
"I shall gather the herbs you will need, should your leg trouble you further, or should anyone incur an injury,"
she told him as she turned and walked away, wishing she could be there to heal Dylan if he were wounded.
"But I know not how to administer them," Robert protested, following her.
"I shall give you instructions for their uses."
"Why do you not simply accompany me?"
Robert's concern for his brother must be immense if he were willing to endure her company, just the two of them and his squire, for such a trip.
"I cannot go against your brother's wishes, Robert."
"I am," he reminded her.
"You are his brother. You are family." I am but a healer. Lord Dillon wishes me to remain here at Westcote, so I shall remain here at Westcote.
Aye, wise one, he murmured with a hint of contrition. Forgive me for pressing you. She smiled.
You become more like your brother every day.
Birdsong flirted with Dillon and his party, bouncing from one side of the road to the other and back. Faint rustling sounds filled the gaps in between as small creatures foraged in the detritus that littered the forest floor. A cool breeze wound its way through the men, preventing the bright sun above from roasting them in their mail and thickly padded gambesons. Riffling the manes of the horses, it continued on to pluck golden leaves from the trees. Dillon listened with only half an ear to the conversations of his men. His thoughts kept returning to recent events, particularly to those that had involved the wise woman. Did she truly believe he would never wed? When he had told her of his dream, a dream he had been so sure was a sign, though he shared not her gifts, she had deemed it impossible. Had she seen the future, dreamed of it, even as he had? Or, knowing the truth now of his sexual conquests, if one could call them that, did she believe no gentlewoman would have him, that none could love him? He scowled at the rutted and pitted dirt road that stretched before them. He supposed she would be the best judge. She knew him better than anyone did. How many nights had the two of them spent hunched over a game of chess or nine men's morris, exchanging quips or sharing a comfortable silence or even engaging in heated debate? Why could he not find a bride who would be willing to do such, he wondered, frustration mounting, a bride like the lovely woman in his dream who had, at last, given him a taste of true tenderness? Another kind of heated debate arose behind him. Sir Guy and Sir Aubrey had both taken a liking to the cobbler's daughter. Dillon should have left the pair at Westcote and instead brought more seasoned warriors with him, older, uglier, more seasoned warriors, who could not attract a maid's notice if they tried. Then Dillon would not have to hear about it. Gavin began to sing a bawdy tavern song to drown out the young knight's bickering. Lucifer's arse. They had been traveling for less than a day, and Dillon already tired of their company. His mood darkening, he opened his mouth to bark out a command to silence them. Something slammed into his right shoulder. Grunting, Dillon clamped his teeth shut as fiery pain erupted in his shoulder and traveled down his arm, burning him as though someone had touched a torch to his flesh. Looking down, he glared at the quarrel that had pierced his armor. "To arms!" Sir Lawrence cried. Swords left sheaths. Dillon forced the fingers of his right hand to curl around the hilt of his own sword. Growling in agony, he drew it from its sheath and laid it across his lap as he searched for the archer who wielded the crossbow. Another bolt embedded itself in his right thigh. Guy and Aubrey, the men he had only moments earlier regretted bringing, closed in on both sides of him, trying to place themselves between Dillon and the one intent on killing him. But Dillon had already located the archer. Bellowing in fury, he urged his mount forward. The powerful destrier charged off the road and into the forest. Halting just inside the trees, Dillon dropped the reins, drew a dagger with his left hand, and launched it at the fellow trying to duck behind the trunk of the tree whose branches supported him. Dillon watched with satisfaction as his blade buried itself deep in the man's chest. Guy pointed his sword. "There and there!" As the archer tumbled to the ground, Dillon followed Guy's aim and saw mayhap a score of men slipping from shadow to shadow. Low tree limbs made it too difficult to follow on horseback. Guy leapt to the ground and raced forward. Aubrey followed on his heels, their squabble forgotten. Dillon slid from the saddle, cursing when it jostled the wound in his thigh, and nigh dropped his sword. His right arm useless, he transferred the sword to his left. Lawrence, Edric, and John headed after the other villains, shouting battle cries. Squires scrambled forward to grab horses' reins. "My lord!" Gideon cried, skidding to a halt in front of him. Dillon motioned for his squire to take control of the destrier beside him, then started forward. Sir Gavin grabbed him by his uninjured arm and halted him.
Let the others rout them out whilst I tend to your wounds.
Dylan shook his head. They outnumber us. My wounds can wait. Just break the shafts.
The burly warrior hesitated a moment, then grabbed the shaft of the bolt protruding from his shoulder and snapped off the bulk of it. Dylan growled as his pain doubled. Gavin did the same with the quarrel in Dylan's thigh, allowing him to move more freely without the shafts catching on branches. Sucking air in through his clenched teeth, Dylan tightened his grip on his sword.
Go with Guy and Aubrey.
Nodding, Gavin headed after the duo, who had already caught up with the bandits and engaged them in battle. Dylan turned to see how Lawrence and the others fared. A third crossbow bolt struck him in the chest with such force he stumbled back a step. More fiery agony. Stunned, he looked to the archer he had felled. The man lay in a motionless, broken heap on the forest floor, no weapon in his hand. Two archers. There were two archers. He opened his mouth to warn his men, but found he could not draw enough breath to do so. His chest, where it did not hurt from the arrow, felt tight. His heart began to race. His legs weakened. Someone shouted his name. Gideon, mayhap? A roar, like that of an enraged bear, filled the forest. Staggering backward, Dylan bumped into his destrier, then leaned against it. His eyes searched the trees above and around them until he found the second archer.
There!
He cried as loudly as he could and pointed his sword at the man. A dagger embedded itself in the man's throat. Dylan sank to his knees. His breath grew short and choppy, crackling in his lungs like dried leaves. His head began to swim. Blood wet his gambeson, tunic, and hose. Unable to remain upright, he collapsed onto his back. A large form barreled forward and grabbed the archer before he could hit the ground. Dylan blinked as the newcomer impaled the dying archer with his sword, then found another victim, and another, tearing through them like a hungry wolf. Robert? Satan's blood! What was Robert doing there? Fighting like a berserker, 'twould seem, killing anyone within reach with ruthless precision. Gideon knelt beside Dylan and put pressure on the wound in his chest, attempting to staunch the flow of blood. Dylan groaned, darkness beginning to cloud his vision. He knew not how long the battle raged as he lay there, struggling for breath and cursing his inability to fight alongside his men. Robert dropped to his knees and leaned over him, his blue eyes wild, his face and tunic glistening with the blood of those he had slain. Dylan! Releasing his sword hilt, Dylan raised his left hand. Robert clasped it. All but one are dead, and he will only live long enough for us to question him. He looked at someone beyond Dylan. Guy, my sack, quickly! His brother's blue eyes held such fear when they returned to Dylan's.
Wise one,
Dylan uttered. Robert nodded.
I shall get you to her. Aubrey!
Aubrey joined them down on the ground as the others crowded around.
Aye? Put pressure on his wounds.
Robert gave Dylan's hand a squeeze. I shall be but a moment, brother. Rising, he grabbed Gideon and guided him over to the young squire's horse. Through the legs of his men, Dylan saw the two engage in heated discourse before Robert bellowed,
Marcus!
Did they argue over how to get him back to Westcote? If so, it did not matter. Dylan had seen wounds such as this in past battles. As Gideon and Marcus conferred, Robert returned to Dylan's side and began removing Dylan's mail. Every jerk, every jostle sent new waves of pain careening through him. Robert took a blade to Dylan's gambeson around the base of each arrow shaft. From his sack, he drew packets of herbs he sprinkled on the wounds with hands that shook. Dylan's thoughts went to the woman who had no doubt supplied those herbs. When he had told the healer about the bride in his dream, she had as much as said he would never wed.
Sorceress,
he whispered.
I will get you to her, brother,
Robert vowed again. Dylan paid him no heed. The seer had been right. He would never wed the woman in his dream. He would not live long enough to find her.